Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. This is episode 207. My name is Paul Murphy, your host via the Bella Lost Souls podcast. On this episode, we're going to debate the different virtues of the assassins and how to help out armies that are Marine armies, specifically Imperial armies that don't have a Primarch. We're going to talk about the chaos side of this also and some things you're going to see on the tournament scene. Thank you very much for joining us. If you don't know, we're also broadcast on YouTube. I'm joined tonight by Andrew Whitaker and Chris Morgan.
What's up, homies?
Putting the sass in assassin.
And Ricky Addington.
I forgot anything I was going to say after
It's Chris. Hard to follow that, man. It's hard to follow that. This segment is brought to you by the Table of Ultimate Gaming. And when we say Ultimate Gaming, they have a Kickstarter going on right now. There are going to be about 6 days to go by the time you see this. Right now, at the time of this recording, they're almost $866,000. That's hard to believe, considering their original goal was $25,000. They have blown past it with something that's actually pretty awesome. So the Kickstarter, what they keep mentioning is that the Kickstarter has discounts built into it. That's kind of the nature of the Kickstarter campaigns. And so if you are even remotely interested in picking up one of these, go and pledge at even their minimalist level, and that will give you the option to participate in their pledge manager after the campaign ends. So you can lock in those discounts and get what you want. Even if you can't pledge within the next few days or so, you still get you will get the option of altering your minimum amount to be able to get the table at the discount. And they have lots of different options, from coffee tables for different gamings all the way up to our style of 4x6 gaming and more. Check it out. They've been awesome to work with. Really happy to have them on the show and really thankful that they chose us as one of the ways to promote this. It's awesome.
I wish so much that I had a whole other room in my house so that I could just slap a Table of Ultimate Gaming in
soon,
there.
Soon.
And tell my wife to never come in. Get out.
Our man, Amber Brownwitz, has gone off and started his own show. We're very thankful of his service here and wish him the best. So guys, check him out and wish him well in his endeavors.
Huzzah, I'm actually on episode 1 of his show as well, so I'm sure all of our cast members here are going to be featured on his show, and we do wish him well, and Adam is going to do great things, so definitely download, subscribe, and leave him a 4-star rating. Remind him that we're still the better show.
Save the 5 stars for us. There you go. Thank you very much. You know, definitely, it takes a lot to do a weekly show, and you know, he's been with us for a lot of years, so again, wish him the best. But this episode, we're going to talk about the virtues of assassins. We have had, this is no lie, we've got a magnitude of request to talk about or to ask people asking us which are the better assassins. And because there are 4 of them, you could have a different opinion of this. I have my 2 favorites, the Vindicare and the Evisor, but I think yeah. You can make a case for at least one other.
So it's funny, Paul and I, both of us got requests from no less than 4 or 5 different just random people on the internet that were like, hey, I want this particular assassin, or what are your thoughts on this particular assassin? And then when we got on the show tonight, we're like, hey, let's talk about assassins, because I think there's a lot to discuss here. As Paul said, he's a big Evisor Vindicare guy. I'm a big Kalexis Evisor guy. I think, you know, the Vindicare is an overpriced sniper. But there's something to be said for the Kalidus too. So we definitely want to discuss all that. And I think that ultimately the first response I have is it depends so much on what else is in your list. So we definitely want to tackle that issue.
Can I frame this a little bit starting out? Is that one of the topics we were going to talk today about, how do you build an Imperial list or I guess a Marine body list in general? Just something, a 3+ armor save, power armor list when you don't have a Primarch in your chosen faction, in your chosen flavor of any of this. Inevitably, I think it leads to a build that includes assassins of some kind. And I'm going all the way to like Black Templars, Grey Knights, Raven Guard on the Imperium side. We'll talk about the Chaos side too, but on the Imperium side, in my personal builds, it always leads to about 200 or 300 points worth of assassins.
Okay, that's fair. All right, touche. That's a lot of assassins, right? You're talking 3 or 4 assassins.
Yeah. Well, you got to take what is it? It's the spearhead. Is it the spearhead? No, it's the Vanguard detachment, I think, that's elites.
Yeah, there's 1 HQ and 3 elites, right?
Right. So you've got to spend some points on the HQ, you know, whether that be an Inquisitor or Primaris Psyker or whatever, and then you got to buy the assassins.
And what is it that you get out of the assassins? Like, say, you know, I've got Gilliman and you've got 3 assassins. Like, where's the trade-off there?
Well, okay, it's hard. Gilliman is such a force He's so, in my opinion, a tad bit under-costed for what he does. I mean, Gilliman is like the Agrax Earthshade of army list inclusions. Ubiquitous. Like, he is plastic talent. Right?
I need that on a t-shirt.
I'm not kidding.
You open up Army Builder or Battle Scribe, and it's like, oh, he's just there.
He's there.
He generated the list. There he is.
It's like in 5th edition or whatever, like Heldrakes. You were building a Chaos list. Your Heldrakes were there when you opened up Army Builder. I mean, that's the way it was. Now, I'm not saying don't include him.
Well, I think it's important. I mean, I was talking to a buddy of mine the other day, and I was like poking his brain. I was like, what do you think of the Salamanders chapter tactics? What do you think Black Templars? What do you think of Imperial Fists? And he looked at me, and he was dead serious. It was just the most like serious look at his face. He's like, I have no idea what those chapter tactics are. He's like, they don't have Robo. Why would I read what they do? And I was like, that's a fair point. Why would you ever care what anything else does without Robo if you're a Marine player?
For the love of the game, man.
Just for a competitive ability, though, he was just like, I think I maybe read them, but like, who cares? You are going to take Robo. And for better or for worse, that's just kind of the state of the game.
He's very powerful. This is not a statement about what's powerful or what you should do. But we do get questions about, like, I want to build a Black Templar list. I want to build a Raven Guard list. I want to do this. I want to do that. You know, and so this is why we think outside the box. I mean, like, I still think Assault Centurions are good. I think they're really great with Raven Guard, and you can make a case for them in Black Templars. And I stand by that. I've gotten those figures. I've built those figures and play those figures. I play those casually because it's tough to make them expressly competitive in the tournament scene. But when I'm building these lists, even Grey Knight lists, I still find myself like, man, I need some board control. I need some early threats. I need some consistency or whatever. And I find myself going to the assassins.
Now, I can totally see where you're coming from with that, Paul. Now, my question for you is, do you split your points between a couple different types of assassins, or do you go all in on just one type of assassin depending on the army list?
I try to stay somewhat themey when I'm building for fun. And I say for fun, I want to win games. This is not about like, oh, I'm just playing casual. No, I'm playing for the throat, but I do try to stick within a theme. And so for things like Black Templar, and even Grey Knights to some degree, I've gone with like three Eversor assassins. Because I like what they bring to the table.
So I think there's a very fine line between I'm trying to play competitively. Let me rephrase. Anytime you start adding non-Black Templar models into your Black Templar list, you scratch away
like a Black Templar player.
Exactly.
This right. has been and a so, point of debate between Andrew and I for a year, almost a year at this point, about what really makes a Black Templar force. And it's but this is important because it's not just the chapter tactic.
Yeah, I mean, there's something to be said for like a substantive composition of the army. I mean, I think it started with you guys building an Adepticon list for the team tournament that you were like, I've got Black Templar Grav Centurions. And I was like, that's not a Black Templar list. You have a Grav Centurion, Grav Tubs. Like, okay. You know, that never struck me as a...
No, this is fair. This is a fair debate. So, I mean, you're not hitting below the belt. I think this is very fair to discuss this.
And ultimately, like, whatever you're coming at, right? Like, it's not like... It almost feels like I'm trying to have, not me necessarily, but anyone who's going to toe the line that says, if you have 600 points of non-Black Templar stuff in your army, or if you're playing a shooty Black Templar list that you're not really playing BT, it seems like they're trying to grasp for some kind of moral high ground. And in 40K, that's just not a thing, right? Like,
no, the Golden Throne kills 3,000
people every day.
On the competitive side,
exactly.
The moral high ground, you can't have that discussion without a grain of salt.
Correct.
Well, when you choose to go mono faction, you accept the limitations that come with that. Like, you have to. You can't say, well, I want to play Black Templars, but I still want to bring Gilliman and have it still be a Black Templars list. But if you're saying I'm going to be pure Black Templars and it's still going to work the same as a Gilliman list, then you're wrong. You're just wrong. It's not going to be.
But Chris,
yeah, it's not nearly as good.
My Gilliman is actually Sigismund.
Yes.
I don't think Sigismund would want to downgrade like that.
if the long pause gets edited out of the show, understand that there was like a dead silence before we moved on to the next.
I will say, so there's a definite difference between like, all right, I want to play these particular models or this particular list, but I want to incorporate this particular powerful tournament tool. So Robot's a good example where you're like, all right, well, this is my Sigismund model, and so I'm going to play him in Black Templars and make them better that way. Okay, that makes sense. If you want to paint up a Robot model in black armor with big white knight hospitaler-like crosses, cool. Go to town. That seems like Fluff City. For me, for my bit, like I have six painted Lehman Russ tanks, and I absolutely play with Knight Commander Paskinov every single round, right? I've got these Vestroian army, but Pask is just too powerful to pass up, so I play him painted blue and call him a Vestroian. There's some Fluff City in there.
Are you saying one is different than the other? Or are you saying that both of those are fine if that's what you
Both of those are fine.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Both of those are fine. In my mind, that's absolutely equal. I can't in good conscience be like, oh, I'm going to put Pask in my my particular guard army, but then poo-poo you if you're going to put Robot in your Black Templar.
I was only using that as an example. I think that our hobby time is kind of our own, like the way it's our own to budget and manage. But let's talk about let's put this in the sense of like how to make a competitive Marine list and when we don't have a Primarch. And my solution is go towards some amount of points of assassins, and then all the questions that we've got about assassins. It seems like I can't be the only one that thinks that way. So let's talk about the best assassins.
Yeah.
Best is relative. We're going to have different opinions.
Let's start with you, Paul.
Now, Chris, points on assassins are approachable, right? I mean, there's not a single one of them that's over 100 points.
Yeah.
And what, the Vindicare is 70 points?
Yeah, let me get that pulled up. I've got the profiles up.
I think he's incredibly inexpensive.
The Calidus is 80. The Culexus is 85. The Eversor is 70.
Oh, okay. Wow, okay.
And the Vindicare is 90.
Yeah, Vindicare, yep, exactly what Andrew said.
That may be why I always gravitate towards the Eversor, because he's, for what he does, he's incredibly inexpensive.
Three of them is 210. That's a nice little slice.
As they say on American Pickers, that's a good get.
Well, the reason that I go towards the Eversor is because that they do get to start, they get to basically infiltrate, start 9 inches away from a model, and they get the 3d6 when they're doing their charge. So you can reliably do a charge out of the shadows with these guys, and they hit decently well.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of hit like a truck in a lot of ways. I mean, there's six attacks hitting on twos at strength 5, AP minus 1, 1 damage. If they're going to swing the Neuro Gauntlet, they can also swing a regular Power Sword if you're swinging on a particularly armored entity.
That could be a tank. You could be swinging on a tank. You could be swinging on anything and get that neg 3 with the Power Sword or do the extra strength with the Gauntlet.
Correct. So it's 3d6 on the charge, and on the turn they charge, it's plus 2 attacks. So you're looking at 8 attacks hitting on 2s. That will really, really put a hurt on a lot of infantry units in the game.
Include Devastator squads. It could include heavy weapon teams. It can include, I mean, there's lots of different stuff. I don't know if I was going to say Noise Marines, but I think that would be be bad with their ability to fire and death and Overwatch. But, you know, there's lots of soft targets out there that you can actually put some damage on.
Well, and the benefit for that comes from the different ways that you can attack with it. So you've got, you know, the Neuro Gauntlet, which is it lets you reroll failed wound rolls, and that's great for the low armor value targets. But for the ones like the Marines you're talking about, the Devastator squads or whatever, then you're going to want to go with the Power Sword.
I'm feeling it, but this. So we talked about what is one of the most inexpensive ones. Then the Vindicare is on the other side of that at 90 points, and that's with war gear included, right?
Yeah, that's the whole package.
None of the assassins have any variance in terms of war gear or cost, right? They're hard costed, the way they're listed. There are no weapon or unit upgrade options. To me, and I, so the Vindicare has its obvious upsides. I think it's, in my opinion, the Vindicare is the least, that's my least favorite assassin. I understand why people like it, but you're rolling a lot of dice to try and get that six on that sniper shot.
Do you think that people like it because they're kind of hyped up on the fantasy of killing the Commissar?
No, yes. Yes, exactly. I think that people are like, well, how am I going to deal with conscripts and Commissars? Well, I brought a Vindicare so I can just dome that Commissar.
A single Vindicare.
Exactly. And that's just not effective.
Yeah.
You got to have two, at least.
Let me state, and you guys don't have to have this opinion, but let me state that three assassins is good of my two favorites, which happen to be the Vindicare and the Evisor.
I don't hate the idea of, I mean, I would go two Evisors, maybe one Vindicare in the back, but.
But see, one Vindicare is not going to get it done, Ricky.
Here's the thing. Like, the Evisors would be up front putting all the pressure on, and then the Vindicare could just sit back there and plink away.
And spend two turns killing the Commissar?
Yeah, you're right.
This is my rub with the Vindicare, right? Everything that Paul just said is exactly accurate. There are times when the Vindicare rolls that hot six and it just explodes, you know, Belisarius call in one turn of shooting. Like, bam, I just did six mortal wounds or whatever it is, and I just murdered this, you know, the Primaris captain or whatever it is. And for every one of those games, there's six or seven games where the Vindicare pops off, does a couple of mortal wounds a turn, you roll a one with your to wound roll, and he does nothing, right? And so, to me, that 70 points is better spent elsewhere.
And then they use their warlord trait and feel no pain.
90 points.
Yeah. 90 points for the Vindicare. He's the most expensive and the least consistent upside. He has the highest variance of upside, but I would rather spend those 90 points more consistently elsewhere.
You're better off putting Rattlings in there. Two Eversers and a squad of Rattlings. Move on with your life.
I think that's fair. To me, the Vindicare and the Kalexis are the most situationally valuable, which makes them the least attractive for a take-all-comers type setup. The Kalexis is very much like, well, you can't shoot me on psychic powers. You need sixes to hit me. I've got this big, you know, seemingly impervious guy, the character model, that can just sit out front and absorb smites. That seems really, really handy unless and until you run into an army that doesn't have any smites. Oh, you know, in which case, they rely on las guns or bolters or orc boys or, you know, even guard armies, whatever it is. If I've just got a volume of fire, I'm going to roll some sixes and I'm going to eventually chew through that. And I don't have to shoot at that Kalexis. And the Kalexis is one of those things that he's not doing enough damage at range to really be valuable. So to me, there are some games where the Vindicare is going to win you the game in the same way the Kalexis is going to win you the game. But those games they don't readily appear enough for those to be the go-to. For me, the Evisor and the Kalidus are the two assassins that you should take.
Well, let's talk about the Kalidus for a second. Why do you say that?
So to me, the Kalidus represents the same deployment and close combat problem that the Evisor represents.
Can I pause you for just one second to talk about that? One of the benefits of the Evisor and things like the Evisor, the reason I feel the way that I do is because immediately when your opponent sees those in your list, he has to make different deployment decisions.
Yes.
So go ahead. That is something that's subtle, but it's immediate that they have to make deployment decisions, and that could it's a decision point that could potentially result in catastrophic failure. But go ahead, Andrew.
I think your point is well made, but I think it serves at least in some small part to kind of double down on why I think the Kalidus is valuable. The Evisor has that I'm going to assault you with 3d6. To get a 9, so, you know, it's something like 60% of the time I'm going to make this assault on turn 1.
You roll 3d6, you add them together, you could potentially just burn a command point on a low number.
Correct.
It makes it a lot more reliable. The 3d6 is hard to deny that
with a command point, you're talking about 70-80% chance of getting into assault on the turn he comes in. Which is great, right? And for I think he's an 85 point model. He does a lot of damage. He has +2 attacks on the charge. All in all, a really, really kind of dangerous model to mess with. Which
is
why,
Chris, how many points is the Evisor?
The Evisor? 70 points.
Yeah. You're talking about is Calidus 85? Who's it?
Calidus is 80, Calexus 85.
Okay, got it.
The Evisor, you can still zone him out. Not zone him out effectively, but you can account for him. He's going to show up 9 inches away. And so you can kind of deploy with some expectations, put buffer units, kind of zone around for that anticipation. The Calidus is such a huge wild card. His special ability is called Polymorphine. It says during deployment, you can set up this model in disguise instead of placing it on the battlefield. At the end of any of your movement phases, this model can revert to its true form, set it up anywhere on the battlefield that is more than D6 plus 3 inches away from an enemy model. For example, if you roll 4, the model can be set up anywhere that is more than 7 inches away from an enemy model. So that's a huge, huge wild card. Best case scenario for the player against a Calidus, he's going to be that same 9 inches away that any deep striking unit is. Worst case scenario, he shows up 4 inches away from you. And there's no zoning out a 4-inch deep strike, 4-inch away deep strike. He just shows up next to you and becomes this huge, huge problem. His Neural Shredder is a really nice Assault 1 Range 9 weapon that does mortal wounds. Can't take that away. And he has two different melee combat options. And then ultimately, he's got hit and run. Old school hit and run, which means if he survives a round of combat, he just drops out, shoots, and then assaults as normal. That's pretty fuego. So to me, at 80 points, he's a much more reliable, consistent damage-dealing pain in my opponent's butt than either the Calexus or the Vindicare.
I can get behind that.
Yeah, just having been on the receiving end of a Calidus once or twice, I can tell you that there's some disruption that's involved with that. But I'm not quite ready to go 100% with you, Andrew, on saying the Calidus has more utility than a Calexus does. I'm pretty solid in Team Calexus right now. And a lot of the reason why has to do with survivability and the nervousness that comes with having a model that's pretty much hard to hit for anything that isn't a Dark Reaper. Being able to go in and snipe units like...
Did you say Dark Reaper?
Yeah. Because the Dark Reaper's rule overrules the Calexus Assassin's...
Oh, it always hits on an XYZ thing?
Yeah, exactly. That's in the Eldari FAQ. And that knocked the Calexus down a peg a bit for me. But I still think that they're really good. And I think that they present many of the same deployment problems that some of the other Assassins, notably like the Evisor do. It's just about picking your target.
I mean, for me, I think there's just a certain amount of deficiency in a power armor-based list that can be supplemented by something like the Assassins because they are easy to fit in one of your detachments and that they are so inexpensive.
Yeah, my problem with the Evisor is I feel like, you know, 70 points for something that they can tie up and chew through some chaff is good, but a Hurricane Bolter is 4 points and does the same job.
That's hard to deny. That is very hard to deny.
I think that what you just said perhaps adds a little bit in favor of the Calidus as well. The phase sword on a Calidus says you can't take invulnerable saves and has a -3 AP. So if you want to eat 5 attacks at strength 4 with that phase sword, you can actually put some serious damage into a entity, whatever it is, be it Thunderhammer, Stormshield, Terminators, or Magnus, or Rowboat, or whoever it is, when you say, well, you don't get any invulnerable saves, and then you're -3 AP on your armor save. You can do some serious damage with that, whereas the Evisor is kind of, like you said, just kind of a chaff eliminating model.
Well, think about this, too. Strength 4 is wounding all the way up to what? Toughness 7 on 5s?
Right.
I still honestly prefer the Calexus to the Calidus in that situation, especially if I'm going up against Magnus. Because Magnus is not going to care about a Calidus Assassin at all.
Certainly that's true, but a guard army doesn't give a crap about the Kalexis and much more cares about an Eversor or a Kalidus, which is my point about how situational the Kalexis is. If you're not a psychic-dependent army, you just don't give a crap about the Kalexis assassin because I don't have to shoot at him. I need sixes to hit him, and he's very survivable and durable, and I mean, it's like that, but he's not really doing anything to me. He's not coming across the board particularly quickly. He's not getting into assault. His weapon isn't doing any cataclysmic damage to me. I can just kind of ignore him unless I'm a psychic-dependent army, which is it's a matchup. It's a situational matchup issue.
Right. And I think that's, you know, the likelihood of a Kalidus assassin putting the hurt on a model like Magnus or Gilliman or whatever and ignoring the invulnerable save, I think just the odds behind them getting reliable wound rolls on those models is not good enough that I'd feel like look, this assassin is going to kill Gilliman. It's not.
No, yeah, definitely.
Both assassins are going to do a really good job of killing things like Devastators, tying up artillery platforms, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, I think you need this stuff to supplement lists that don't have these overhand rights in the form of the big characters and things that we've talked about. I think the assassins fill some of those holes because they make your opponents have decision points. And that's ultimately what like the big things like Gilliman and Magnus and Mortarion now are going to do, is going to give your opponent decision points that you can capitalize on if they make the wrong choice. And I think that's ultimately what it is. So I'm not sure we've solved the question about which assassin is the best. I think that we have, though, kind of come to all agree that putting your faith in one Vindicare is probably not where you want to be. You're going to need multiples. But I think that's the same sense for most of these assassins. Most of the good assassins, sure, you're going to want multiples. But it's a slim point investment. We're talking about 300, 350, maybe 400 points total out of your army to have this big disruption element.
Yeah, and you can't help but wonder if some of these problems that we're thinking of tackling with these guys are or aren't going to adjust with things coming out like chapter approved or whatever. So, I mean, this advice may have a timer on it, but I think that there are some universal qualities to these assassins that you can add to your army list that will still end up helping. And it's good to know what they can do, even if you're just thinking you're going to be on the receiving end.
There you go. Before we take a break, I want to talk, Andrew and I actually did a filmed battle report with the Glacial Geek channel on YouTube. We did this last night at our local game store.
It was super fun. We played a Gigabytes. We played a 2,000-point game. The Glacial Geek, Phil, is his name. Really fun guy. Super charismatic. Really fun guy. Super fun game. He played a 2,000-point game. He had Dark Angels and hit me and Paul up and was like, hey, I want to play against you guys. Each of y'all bring 1,000 points. So it was Paul and I versus Phil. We tabled him in 4 turns. Pretty cool. I'm kidding.
Friendly list. I was playing Blood Angels in a fairly – well, I mean, I took a competitive Blood Angel list for as competitive as they can be right now, and you took what I consider a very friendly guard list, including the Malkador Infernus.
Exactly. I took a Fluff City guard list. I brought a Malkador Infernus. I spent more than a third of my points on a single tank. Took some horses and some vets and everything else like that, and we did. It was a really fun game. Obviously, as Paul mentioned, he brought as competitive of 1,000 points of Blood Angels as you could possibly get. That is to say, a terrible Blood Angels list because
Blood Angels are Lamarchies, some now. Death Company, a few Razorbacks, and a Librarian Dreadnought.
Exactly, just like a stiff breeze, and they're all dead. But we had a ton of fun, and like I said, Phil was a really great opponent. So definitely check that out on YouTube. Click and subscribe to the Glacial Geek, and then he's going to link that over to the Forge Narrative page.
He does a great job of editing his battle reports are not just the cam going around. He's got some enthusiasm built in, which is worth checking out.
Yeah, and I thought that the other cool thing was he took a lot of time, which I was kind of, I don't want to say pleasantly surprised at, but he was really focused on making sure that the armies themselves, the models, were showcased. I want to say we take a full 45 minutes before we started playing to take each unit and put them in front of the camera with the lights on them to showcase the painting and the hobby side as well. So you don't have to be a win-at-all-costs whack gamer to appreciate this stuff. You can check out the models, see the paint, see all the detail. That I thought was really, really cool and really, really valuable to say that, hey, we're not all about just gaming here. We want to see really real painted models.
So yeah, and that's the Glacial Geek, just like it sounds, on YouTube. Check him out if you haven't already. You'd see Andrew and I roll some dice.
Exactly. And if you stay to the very end, I think he's going to show our faces. So make sure.
For better or for worse.
Exit out of that before he gets to that
right.
point.
Close out before the end. But it was neat because some people in the shop actually knew who he was. And they came up and said, hey, Phil, I recognize your face. And they heard Andrew and I talking. They're like, hey, I recognize you guys' voice. It was
honestly one of the most surreal moments I've ever had, where some guy walked up and was like, wait. I saw on Twitter that you were talking to Phil, the Glacial Geek. He was like, Twitter or Facebook or something, that you were in Atlanta. I couldn't believe it. And then Phil starts talking to him, and then Paul says something, and the guy looks at Paul, and his eyes get huge. He's like, wait, I recognize your voice. And he's like, Paul's like, yeah, we're the Forge Narrative guys. And he's like, oh my goodness. And Paul goes, and that's Andrew. And the dude looks at me, goes, holy crap. And, you know, you did not do the PG.
This is the store we're
that.
In pretty often.
Exactly. I mean, I was like, we're there every week, man. How do you not know us? But
whatever. That's how communities get built and merge together and expand and stuff. So I'm happy to talk about his channel because he's a cool guy. He just moved here from Alaska. So, you know, now he's in our kind of neck of the woods. So maybe we'll have more collaborations in the future.
Here's hoping.
Guys, hold tight. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back where Chris and I did a segment with someone who is new to the game. He's a gaming contributor for Geek & Sundry and some other properties as well. And he's new to 40K, and Chris has been a great ambassador to the hobby. And we're going to have a segment with me, Chris, and him in between this. And then we're going to come back with the crew we've got right now.
That was a really fun chat, guys. Hope you enjoy it.
Hold tight.
Battlehaven, the world's premier miniatures gaming retreat, is happening this fall. Visit us on Facebook and at battlehaven.us. Join us for 4 days and nights of epic battles, gourmet meals, and luxury accommodations. Incredibly fun, amazingly affordable. Battlehaven.
Hey everybody, welcome to a very special segment of Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul. I got Chris Morgan here.
Hey guys.
And we're joined by another gaming contributor, Rafael Cordero.
Hey guys, thanks for having me on.
Yo man, thanks for joining us.
I really appreciate it. I've been listening to you guys basically since I jumped into 40K, thanks to Chris here. So really excited to be on the show and talk about the game.
Well, just a little background to catch folks up. You are someone, you write about board games mostly, I think. Mm-hmm. And you also have a podcast of your own centered around things that aren't 40K. Mm-hmm. And you've only recently gotten into 40K. And our man, Chris Morgan, was a big contributor to that, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. I jumped into 40K with Dark Imperium basically when that launched. You can't really do too much in the board game world without at least knowing about 40K and hearing about it. And I did try to get into it years ago after I graduated college, but really my first games and getting into it have come with Dark Imperium, basically with the launch of this new 8th edition. And I write for Geek & Sundry, is one of the places I write for, and they had me do a couple articles on sort of the process of getting into it and diving into the world. And Chris reached out to me after one of my posts and has been giving me these awesome, awesome breakdowns of all of the factions and their story, which has been a huge part of getting into the game and having fun, because obviously, as you and all your listeners know, the lore of this is amazing.
So you said Dark Imperium, so that's fresh 8th edition.
You have
no 40K experience, I mean, other than being aware of that it existed prior to this edition of the game.
Yes, I did once buy an Eldar army on Craigslist that sat unplayed for 7 years probably before I finally sold it off. And I think selling it off is what brought us all 8th edition, because it was like 6 months later that they announced it. And I was like, oh, good. I'm glad I sold that whole army.
Yeah. All right. So now all I have to do, dang it, I'm out of armies to sell. I can't sell the one that I have.
Yeah.
Man, that's awesome. So, I mean, let's talk about that, if you don't mind, about what attracted you to the universe to begin with. I assume that you do have some figures, whether it's the Dark Imperium set or mm-hmm. you've gotten some since then. But let me know about that progress of someone that's just coming in fresh. Because we talk a lot on the show about that history of like going from third to second to third, all the way up to eighth where we are now. You know, none of that means anything to you. What got you into this edition, and how have you been progressing through the hobby since for the last couple of months or so?
Sure. So it all started back when I was in college. The Warhammer MMO, Age of Reckoning, I think is what it was called. was launched as a video game, and that I started playing that, and I thought, oh hey, I learned about the Fantasy Battles miniatures game, and I thought, ah, that seems kind of neat. I'm about to graduate and move to somewhere where I don't know anybody. Maybe I can find a community and make some friends through that. So that is what introduced me to the game in general and Games Workshop and all of that. And when I moved out here to Chicago, I went to a store, and most of the people in the store were 40K players. So I had some miniatures for Fantasy that I had started painting, really loved painting, and decided I was going to try to jump into 40K with a friend from work. And it didn't really work out. Our schedules never synced up for us to be able to play. And the group at the store, they were all really nice people when I was there, but they were all a lot younger than I was. And I had just graduated college, so I was still pretty young myself. So it never really meshed. So it kind of faded into the background, went away. And then I've started getting into board games in the past few years here. And my podcast co-host used to play 40K and Necromunda and all of these games that he talked about kind of with really fond memories. And he's the one who got me excited about 8th edition. He's the one who told me, he's like, hey, they're launching this new starter set. It sounds awesome. It seems really neat. The rules are, they're doing a big refresh and a streamlining. And I was thinking, okay, well, like I said, I had this Eldar army in the basement that had been taunting me for years that I never got to play. And I decided maybe this is the right opportunity. Yeah, exactly. It was there, always kind of lurking on the periphery. And I thought 8th edition might be a good opportunity to jump into it. And the thing about Dark Imperium that was great is that it was and especially Know No Fear, they're really nice starter sets to introduce someone not just to the game, but to the hobby part of it. And so I knew I liked painting miniatures. Actually, even though I'd never played 40K or ever played Fantasy, I kept picking up individual models here and there just to paint them because they're so much fun to paint. And I thought, well, you know, nothing else. I'll get the starter set. I'll see what it's like. I'll paint some miniatures and that part will be fun. And it took me like half a game of 8th edition to say,
well, this edition is very great. Accessible, and it has a lot of interaction, which I think is, if people have sometimes old habits and old perceptions die hard, as the case may be, but previous editions in the last couple or so weren't as dynamic and weren't as fast moving. And okay. Now the board state changes. There's interaction between armies that we haven't seen before. There are very powerful things and very cool things, but you can affect them even if you bring something that you've just brought the figs that look the best to you. Sorry, figures. That's the vernacular. Mm-hmm. Don't want to go too fast here, you know. But
yeah, I'm still easing myself in. Come on.
Right, but you bring the figures that are interesting to you, you can still do something in this edition to where in 7th and 6th and stuff you couldn't before. So the game is very accessible to anyone that is in your similar situation or maybe have heard some things or played in 4th and didn't like where things were previously. Here we are in a place where things happen. You get to move the figures that you want around. So do you have you gotten any figures past that main first starter set yet?
I have, yeah. So I have Dark Imperium and Know No Fear, which I so through my review work, I got a chance to play Know No Fear and write a review about it. And that set, I think, is phenomenal because of the way it introduces the rules to you through those scenarios. That was really good. And then after talking to Chris, and Chris was giving me these faction breakdowns, I kind of fell in love with the orcs. And I found someone getting out of 40K. I don't think they'd bought any new models since 5th edition or something like that when I asked him. But he was liquidating a 2,000 to 3,000 point orc army that I got for what felt like nothing. So I was actually able to jump into this.
That's awesome. Orcs on paper at least look really awesome. I've not had a chance to play against a super competitive orc list in the last couple of months, but it looks like it's going to be a good and fun army, and Games Workshop has a history of doing cool things for orcs.
Okay, that's good to hear. I mean, yeah, I love them.
In my area, orcs have been doing really well. We've had a couple of the local tournaments where orc players have done well, either won or made it in the top four. And it's great to have a faction that you love that's really, really fun to play. And orcs just like the nice thing about them in 40K is they kind of break that whole take everything so seriously kind of vibe that, I mean, it often 40K feels just so intense.
Sure.
So you kind of roll your shoulders with the orcs and loosen up a bit, and that you still take them seriously as a force on the table and as a cool faction.
Yeah,
and at the same time, you can be silly.
Yeah, and that's actually a really nice thing about the orcs, because the first time I built a list to go play, I had no idea what I was doing. I downloaded Battlescribe, and I thought, hey, this will kind of walk me through the process. And we were going to play a 2,000-point game. It was going to be a full game. I didn't really quite understand power levels, and my opponent was same thing. He's like, let's just do points. So I said, all right, 2,000 points, let's go for it. But I was kind of worried that I wasn't going to have enough models to fill to reach 2,000 points. And he mentioned something about bringing Magnus, which didn't mean anything to me other than Googling it and seeing an awesome miniature and thinking, yes, I want that on the table when we play, right? So I thought, all right, cool, I'll build my list. And by the time I built it and packed everything up to ready to go, I didn't appreciate that my two battle wagons and truck had no weapons. I guess I was used to the Dark Imperium set where assuming everything came with something. So I'm there ready to play, and I'm driving these big vehicle miniatures across it that have no weapons besides the base melee attack, which is ridiculous. I don't recommend that for any of you competitive players. But
so there you go. Yeah, getting accustomed to how to build an army now, it's different than it's ever been. I'll say that. And so even us old guys that have been playing for a long time, it's still a little bit of an adjustment.
Right, because you have to buy everything individually, and that's something that's different, right?
But I think you do it once, and you've at least got an appreciation for the process.
Oh, sure. And now that was definitely a great lesson to learn, to realize how ineffective it is to just try to drive
to kill
a truck
Magnus
repeatedly.
Running over with a
hook. Yeah, like some Rupert Grint who just literally stood their ground while a truck spun its wheels in the mud trying to roll them over. It didn't work so well.
Lessons learned, you know.
Yeah, right. But it makes it kind of a funny experience.
Yeah, I mean that's the cool thing about, I guess, playing the game. You do that once, and the game moves so fast now. You could in a night, in an evening, you could technically play a couple of games, especially if that one game goes so quickly.
Yeah, well, and coming at it from board games, one of the things that I look for a lot in games these days is a game that is still fun to play while you're losing, right? Because there's a lot of games out there that are, for whatever reason, if you're not doing well, can feel like you're being beat down either by your opponent or by the systems of the game itself. And I have found 40K personally to be a fun game to play even while losing, because even if you don't, you know, take your opponent off the table or capture all of the objectives, you can usually find something that feels like you feel like you accomplished something. You took out this unit, or you put some wounds onto their big model, or there's a little pocket of funny story over here that's
that interaction engaging. I was referring to. Absolutely. Yeah. And then that is something that is returned with this edition, and it's one of the things that's been so enjoyable to play. I've said this before on the main show, but I've played more casual games of 40K in the last 3 months than I probably had in the last 2 years.
Wow.
Still play tournaments and, you know, and getting ready for tournaments, but I'm talking about just, hey, let me just throw some miniatures on the table and see if I can make something work.
Mm-hmm. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, it seems like the power level system makes that a little bit easier, or at least remove some of the barriers to be able to just plop some stuff on the table and pick from
the
list.
The power level system definitely does. Now, that whole thing about not bringing weapons on your tank, in a power level system, they're there anyway. You're just buying the model, and pretty much whatever you've glued onto the model is what you get to take. I mean, as long as it's an option for it, but there's a lot less of the, tedium's a bad word, but there's a lot less of the accounting and bookkeeping in the back of the book when you're just going through and picking things that fit into your force organization, your detachment, based on what either is on the model or what looks cool to you.
Yeah, and then that's one of the big barriers, I think, for people like me who have come from some of the board game side of the hobby versus the miniatures game side of the hobby, is that learning curve that can feel like a steep wall to start. I think the power levels, my limited experience so far has been that really smooths that out quite a bit.
With five pages of rules, I mean, I think it's 12, but but four or five of like real meaningful rules pages, and in the power level system and the codexes and the indexes, it's, you can start playing 40K if you have the models, like the starter set or the easy build models. Mm-hmm. You can start playing 40K quicker than you can play some board games.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Especially, I think, what's it called? First Strike is the starter set that comes with push fit models. But definitely No Fear. If you've got those miniatures built, then yeah, that's getting you up and playing really fast. And not in a way that feels incomplete, I guess. Or I mean, I'm probably never going to go play the first mission of No No Fear, which where the Poxwalkers don't even get to attack. But that still felt like a little story that I got to play out as part of this tutorial, not like someone holding my hand, I guess.
I gotcha. Okay. Very cool.
Yeah.
So what do you see yourself going next? So you got the orcs. I assume you have a handful of marine models and maybe even some chaos models.
Yeah, I didn't get rid of either side of the starter set. So and like I said, I lucked into a great orc collection. So that's other than painting it the way I want my army to look, that's pretty much done. So I think I've really, really gotten into the lore of the Death Guard, and the Dark Imperium book was really neat with that slow creeping horror. So I think I'm going to really just try to focus on getting my Death Guard painted to something that I like, and maybe pick up a tank, you know, whenever they release those new tanks that should be coming out soon, or maybe a Terminator
those
squad or something like that.
Those tanks are beefy.
I heard you guys talking about them with the mortaring and stuff like that, and that sounded really great.
With just a tad bit of luck, they are incredibly survivable. They do so much. They do damage. They do lots of damage. Speaking of in close combat, they have 3 attacks in close combat.
Hey, I mean, that'd be great.
Sixes, but you know,
pop a wheelie and just gunk. Yeah.
Maybe that becomes relevant to you if that becomes one of your strategies.
Yeah, maybe this could be my calling card. Like I'll be that guy known for just trying to drive over people.
Actually, I forgot to bring ammo this time, so forge that narrative.
Yeah, there we go.
So I'm a board game guy too. I love board games. I love playing. Mm-hmm. Betrayal at the House on the Hill, I think, is my favorite board game.
Oh man, I know so many people for whom that is their favorite board game.
It's one of those things you can play in. It says in the box you can play it in an hour, and you really do get an experience in an hour.
Sure.
And it's different every time. So it's one of the things I love. So, but while I've got you on, another board game enthusiast, what are some other board games out there that you like and maybe the people should check out that you've had a chance to play or you've heard about or whatever?
Yeah, sure. So the one that I am in love with right now is called the Arkham Horror Card Game. And it's by a company called Fantasy Flight Games. They up until a few months ago, they had the Games Workshop license, and it's got a lot of moving parts. And normally I wouldn't recommend this to people I didn't know, but given that your audience is familiar with Warhammer and thus totally capable of navigating, you know, some rules overhead, it tells one of the best stories in board gaming right now that you can get, this Arkham Horror card game. It's one of Fantasy Flight's living card games. So you kind of make an initial investment on a core set, and then every month or so they put out the small packs that is another story. You're playing through a structured campaign, and you pick a deck you like with a character you like, and you build a deck around them with some pretty simple deck building rules. And then over the course of this campaign, your character is getting a little bit stronger. You're swapping your cards out based on kind of what you think you need. And the first campaign that they've released, the Dunwich Legacy campaign, just finished, and they're about to drop. Maybe it's already out by the time people listen to this. The next little expansion that kicks off the next campaign. So that's something that I've been kind of in love with for the past year. That it's got some rules to it, but I don't think it's over the top for people who already play games, I guess.
Okay.
So that's one. Another one that is much, much simpler, but no less fun, is called Ethnos. It just came out a few months back, I think. It's a little bit under the radar because the company that put it out, CMON, is known for their huge games full of miniatures. They're doing the Game of Thrones miniature game. They've done Zombicide is one that a lot of people have heard of. Rising Sun's another huge title. So this one kind of flew under, went straight to retail without Kickstarter, but it's a lot of fun. This is one you can play in about an hour, 45 minutes to an hour, depending on how fast you play. And it's this tight little area control game where you're all fighting over control of an island that's broken up into these provinces. And the main mechanic is drawing cards from a public pool and playing those cards out of your hand to form these, like, you're basically just matching either colors or monster types, but like dwarves do something different than minotaurs. If you have a dwarf who's leading your set of cards, that your power is a little bit different than if a minotaur is leading it, right? So that's kind of where your strategy comes in. But it's super simple. It's a touch simpler than Ticket to Ride, which is a very well-known board game that you can play with anybody. But it's a little more aggressive. It's a little more in your face. So those two are some big recommendations I've got right now. And I could talk about board game recommendations for hours.
Well, you've got a show about that, right?
I mean, yeah, exactly.
Well,
yeah.
What's that? We didn't mention the name before. What's your podcast?
The podcast is called Ding and Dent, and I have a co-host, Charlie. And we do it together. Comes out every 2 weeks, and we're big on narrative games, games that tell stories, games that are really exciting and kind of in your face. They're known as Ameritrash games on that side of the hobby versus Euro games, which are a lot more economic and don't often have as much direct player interaction.
Those are industry terms.
Yes.
Those are actually real things that people say to refer to types of games if you aren't familiar with that.
Yes, exactly. So we're much more on those narrative story in your face games. And we do try to keep up on new releases. Each episode has usually got a couple new release games that we're talking about it. We do some big reviews, and every now and then we do special topics, bring people on the show, stuff like that. And we have covered 40K. We've even covered some RPGs, but our bread and butter for sure is the board game stuff.
If you have not checked out Takedo, I highly recommend that as well.
Yes, that's a really interesting game, but that is one of those that's very different. It's kind of serene almost.
Well, I love it because you can play with people who have no interest in strategy. They get kind of involved in their journey, what their play pieces are doing, and it's slightly more than a game sometimes, but it can be less than a game and still be fun.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it.
Well, Raph, it was really great talking to you, and I really appreciate you coming on and taking some time out to tell us about your journey as a new player getting into 40K and a little bit about what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on. And Chris, huge thank you for those lore introductions that you've been giving me, because like I said, I really enjoyed reading them, and even the factions that I wasn't necessarily drawn to want to collect, I was devouring all of this content. It's amazing how much there is for this game.
Yeah, and I feel like I've only really scratched the surface with it too. I'm glad you're enjoying them. I mean, it's great to live up to my namesake as Chief Librarian, but really, like, I just drink all this stuff up. I'm glad to be able to share it with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Chris is an amazing ambassador of the game. So if anybody else is in your similar situation, feel free to hit us up, and I'm sure Chris will be able to accommodate with some more lore and tips on how to get going.
And if you want that information, like I said, Chris has done an awesome job, which I very much appreciate it. And I think that the story in the background for 40K is part of what helps make the tabletop experience so fun. So
I'd agree, definitely.
Knowing that stuff and having that background when I finally set those models out to play just makes the game so much more fun and enriching, I guess.
All right, everybody, hold tight. We're going to come back with another segment. But Raph, again, it was great speaking with you. Hope we can catch up with you again in the future.
Yeah, thanks again. Really appreciate it.
Take care.
Forged Narrative is brought to you by Dicehead.com. www.dicehead.com. Games, hobby supplies, and comics. They have it all.
Hey, everybody, we are back. I'm still Paul. I got Ricky Addington and Chris Morgan.
Hey. How you guys doing?
And Andrew Whitaker.
What's up, homies?
We got Warzone Atlanta coming up here in November. We have added some Friday night events, some interesting, some kind of Beat the Masters. We got Horton, who you'll hear on the show probably next week, and Mike Twitchell, who was our best overall winner last year. He was also the best overall winner at the first major tournament at Atomic Empire. A very talented player. If you have not registered for the team event or the Apocalypse event and still want to play some 40K in a single person capacity, Horton and Twitchell are going to be offering up kind of the Beat One of the Tops. These are always top competitors in the events that they attend, and you could play them one-on-one if you are not already registered for one of the other events. The Friday night fracas going down is a three-person team event. Register if you are coming to Warzone.
Coming in hot.
Love it.
Yeah, and speaking of Warzone, the best painted winner, Luke Slothauer, last year with his beautiful Death Guard force. I can't wait to see how he expands that with everything that we have out now, including Mortarion. I've been painting Mortarion. I just painted the wings today. I painted the main body of Mortarion. You can find that on Twitter at warmaster_TPM. You can see my work in progress on Mortarion. It is a beautiful model. I actually got asked a few hobby questions today on how I would do that. Ask Luke. Luke's won best painted at Warzone. I'm never going to do that. But Andrew, you got to see a preview of Luke's army coming up that he's going to be taking to our event this year.
Yeah, so Luke came over to my place tonight, and we played a 2,000-point game. He's bringing Space Wolves this year. Absolutely marvelous Space Wolves army. And we actually joked, Paul, to your point about how marvelous the Mortarion model is. Luke confessed to me about how it has taken all of his resolve. He's like, I just cannot paint this model yet, because he's like, if I get started on this, I'm never going to finish my Space Wolves in time for Warzone. And so he hasn't even unboxed Mortarion yet. He's like, I just can't even deal with it.
He has.
He's like, got to put it to the side. I can't deal with it yet.
I couldn't do that, man.
I know.
I'm helping a buddy get ready for Warzone too, and I'm painting some of his stuff, and I had to put it all down and work on Mortarion.
It was unbelievable. Like, the look in his face, it was just nothing but pure anguish about how badly he wanted to paint Mortarion, but he had to finish out his Space Wolves army, which is, you know, if you, anyone who's come to Warzone knows, like, we put the general staff and Forge Narrative puts a massive, huge emphasis on paint and presentation. We care so much about how armies look, and we really value that hobby side.
We have four champions. If anyone ever asks who wins Warzone, there are four top winners that are all equal in our eyes. And I believe this to my core, and one of those prizes is best appearance. I mean, that includes the hobby side, the display side. That includes some amount of player votes for player's choice and a judge's opinion. It's all encapsulated in that, and that is one of the champions of Warzone.
There's no doubt about that. I know that, you know, the 2 years of Warzone, Adam won the first year with his Eldar, and then Luke won last year with his Nurgle and Death Guard. And he is right on track with his Space Wolves to be every bit as awesome as last year. So we did play our game tonight. I played a very fun 5 Lehman Russ guard army, and we had a great time tonight. So super excited for him. I didn't see his display board. There's some tricks left in the hat, and his Wolfen aren't quite done. So I still haven't seen the finished product. But rest assured, if you're gunning for best appearance at Warzone this year, you are going to face some stiff competition.
Well, we've got.
I wouldn't bet against Luke.
We have two side prizes that are outside of the main event. There are two side prizes sponsored by the two contributors to the event, General Staff and Forge the Narrative. We have one prize sponsored by the general staff is best display board, best overall look of your army that is completely outside of your tournament placement. And the other award from the Forge Narrative side, I gave it kind of a long name. It's the Forge Narrative Grim Reaper Head Taker Award. That has to do with keeping your warlord alive while dispatching the enemy warlord in all your games. And if there's a tie, so say both players get 10 points each, we're going to award a prize to the top battle point finisher and the least battle point finisher that have the tying score.
So yeah, I would have just called it the Lord Executioner.
Thought about the Highlander. There can be only one award. You know, yep. There's all,
I like,
kind
that
of
one. Yeah.
You know, Princes of the Universe. There's all kind of things you can do with this. But anyway, that's one of the side. But there are two awards that are completely outside of the Grand Tournament competition, and one of them is about just display and appearance and bringing your best look to the event, because it's important.
I think the fact that we take the people who show up with unpainted armies out back and beat them behind the dumpster, that's really helped over the years of making sure everybody brings their A game. So I'm not saying that happens.
After I beat that first assault charge, I knew that I was good to go. You know,
everybody knows what's up at Warzone. How important it is to bring that fully painted army. But
this thing is in Atlanta. It's in Atlanta, people. We ain't messing around down there.
This is the dirty South.
But Luke blew our minds last year. I mean, that was an amazing army with just the color. I mean, again, it was there. He's a competitor in that space. And so we have a little video up on our Warzone Atlanta Facebook page. And so if you're curious about what you need to beat, that's the competition. But it all factors in, you know. And so bring your A game to this event. And there are people here that will challenge you. You think you're a great painter, you will be challenged by many of the competitors at Warzone. And that's one of the highlights of the event.
I don't know about that. I mean, I know that, for example, Ricky, you... Maybe I'm telling you something you've never heard before. You I think, finished second in the voting for best painted in year one, right? You lost by like 2 votes to Adam for best painted with your Imperial Knight Army. And if anyone who's ever seen Ricky's Imperial Knight Army, you'd be like, how could this ever lose to anything? Definitely bring your A game, and it's going to be super fun. So anyway, I say all that to say that Luke came over. We live 2.1 miles away from each other here in Atlanta, and he just showed up, and we rolled dice, ate pizza, drank some bourbon, and it was a really, really really good time. And so anyone who's trying to compete with him for best painted, let me tell you, be afraid, be very afraid.
Know that that's part of the one of the champions of the event. Like, there are ways to win this event that are outside of just the competition side. And so if you didn't get a ticket to the main event, we are sold out at this point in time. Get on the wait list. We do have Friday nights that are events that are available with still slots open. One of them being a team event, a three-man team event that has a pretty unique format. You can find that information on the website. I won't take up too much of our time here.
Just as a vote of encouragement, Paul, I do want to make sure that everyone understands we chewed through the first, 30 people on our wait list last year?
Well, yeah. I mean, with the wait list, there's a – I won't say – we didn't have 30 drops and then 30 people got in. It was a combination.
No, certainly.
It was a combination of everyone – not everyone on the wait list was able to come when they got the offer for the ticket. And so we were able to get through a fairly deep stack on the wait list. So don't think that you shouldn't get on the wait list if you have an interest in coming. You definitely should get on the wait list if you were interested in coming.
That's exactly right. So just jump on it. What's the harm? Worst case scenario, in a few weeks, somebody's going to offer you a ticket and then you can decide then. But definitely jump on the wait list.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to talk about some things that you may see at the tournament. Now, we open the doors up to everything. We play with the lightest touch possible Warhammer 40K. And we tried to only fact or clarify things where there's a real need or discrepancy or something for personal preference, and we completely own it. Objectives having infinite height, for instance, that's one of the things that we feel strongly about to reduce some gaminess, and we include that in an FAQ. Or if there's a discrepancy between a digital and a printed copy, we like to clarify that so you know what to expect when you get here. And these are minor things that don't come up all the time, but it's stuff that exists. And so I want to talk about things that have been getting a lot of chatter on the internet recently, and that is the Malefic Lords and the Giant Chaos Spawn. Now, some of you may be thinking, what in the heck is he talking about? And I agree with you. The Malefic Lords, the Chaos Renegade Psyker, it sounds like it might be a Demon Prince or nothing. No, it's a 25 mil base model. It's actually in the Index Forces from the Astra Militarum Imperial Armor Index. The Forge World Index, the Renegades, the Bad Imperial Guard, are in this book.
Not mine, because I'm an Imperial fanboy. I have cut all of those pages out of my book to keep it pure.
Well, the Malefic...
Yes, well, they start to stink after a while.
Exactly.
The Malefic Lord makes its way into some, heretical soup list because it's so inexpensive. It is essentially a smite caddy for Chaos Space Marines.
How cheap is he?
30 points. 30 freaking
that
points.
That doesn't include war gear. So his last...
Why would you ever put any war gear on him?
Look, I don't know. I don't know. It is a power level 4 creature that has a 4+ invulnerable save, so he's fairly survivable. This unit can attempt to manifest one psychic power in each friendly psychic phase and attempt to deny one psychic power in each psychic phase. It knows the smite psychic power and two psychic powers from the Renegades and Heretic Discipline, and you can find that on 8. It's got 3 other psychic powers, but smite is pretty good.
It is kind of abusive.
Well, let me say one of the reasons... 30 points. It's not just smite. It has a power called Warp Flux. Choose an enemy within 12 inches. It immediately suffers D3 mortal wounds. Against vehicles, it inflicts D6 mortal wounds. Now, that's not smite, and so you have the ability to kind of option it up to something if you become within 12 inches of a vehicle. And it could potentially be, another psychic power in your arsenal if you need it. Not that smite, you can cast it unlimited in a match play, but it does have other mortal wound generation abilities.
Yeah, it has 2 regular psychic powers plus smite. It casts 1 per turn, has 1 denial per turn. It's 4 wounds, has a 4 up invulnerable save. If it suffers a perils of the warp, it has a special rule called warp possession, that if you suffer a perils, you immediately increase your weapon skill plus 2. You go to strength 8.
You hit on
you
a
go
2
to 5
plus
attacks.
Strength 8, yeah.
With exactly. Yep. You Hulk out if you suffer a perils.
And
with 4 wounds, you can't possibly die.
You give a neg 2 to your armor penetration and your fist do 2 damage each. After
exactly.
After you Hulk. You go Super Saiyan.
Yeah, you go Super Saiyan with 5 attacks. You basically, if you perils, you become this monster in close combat. and you're 30 points. And obviously with 8th edition is, and this is, I think, a fair critique. It is essentially unbound, right? 40K, Games Workshop has been intentional about opening up the door. You can play with whatever models you want. And in matched play and in most tournaments, you have three detachments, which ultimately means it's really, really difficult to be limited, to be detachment limited.
You're not. You can build whatever you want. And I misspoke earlier. You don't even have the option of getting the las gun. You hit with your bare hands only. It says a Malefic Lord is a single model armed with only its bare hands.
Right.
That turn into, you know, judo chops.
Exactly. And if I'm not mistaken, it's is it an HQ or an elite?
It's an HQ choice.
It's an HQ choice. So with 8th edition being essentially unbound, you're not really limited in terms of force organization force slots. Force org is not really a thing in 8th edition. It's basically unbound. So what you saw, for example, in the Nova Invitational, the Nova Open, I think there were 7 lists in the Nova Invitational that had no less than 8 Malefic Lords. Because that's 8 smites for 240 points. Why wouldn't you do that? If they perils, they're fine. They're a 4-wound model with a 4-up invulnerable save in and of themselves. Great. They're good in and of themselves for 30 points. And if they perils, they become these just ridiculous close combat tanks. They're almost auto includes if you're going to take them, if you're going to take a chaos list, they're really plug and play. And top to bottom, there's a lot of room to not. I don't want to say they can be abusive.
Well, because they're so inexpensive and they have an immense amount of offensive capability.
Yeah, they're better in every way than a Primaris Psyker, and also 10 points cheaper. So why would you not take them?
I think the Primaris is it 45 points or is
40?
40.
No, it's okay. 40 flat. So it's 25% more expensive, less effective in close combat. Less powerful psychic powers and doesn't become Hulk.
Well, that's what we're seeing on these psychic caddies is that you're not rolling against a leadership anymore. So the base leadership stat doesn't matter. Independent characters don't take morale like it doesn't matter. And you're casting on a target number that is completely disassociated with a leadership value. So if you're paying points for base stats on a model, it's irrelevant when you're using it, when you're including it just for this smite or some other psychic power.
Right, and ultimately, I mean, if you take, like I said, the top lists are taking 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 of these guys. That's, you know, any given turn, you're looking at 7 to 9 D3 mortal wounds. Just that's smiting away. That's a tremendous amount of power.
That's gutting units. That is
it's gutting units.
It's killing some vehicles. It's definitely changing damage categories on vehicles.
Absolutely, and you're certainly not charging forward with Magnus or Mortarion if you're going to charge headlong into 8 smite.
Yeah.
For less than half the cost of the model that it's killing.
Yes. So. One of the test games I played with Mortarion this past couple of weeks, or I guess week or so, was Mortarion got significantly crippled by a bunch of smites and a bolt of change with the swiftness.
Yeah, which is likely to happen, right? That's a thing that happens
without much difficulty.
That's
what it is, because you're activating these psychic powers on a target number that has nothing to do with. So you don't have to invest points into these models because their offense is not changing. It's a static thing based on the casting value of the number and just a little bit of luck.
Yeah, and then the command point variability makes things even more cost effective, right? Because for 30 points, I get this smite caddy that I can, if you know, I can really manipulate how effective he is in the psychic phase with command points. You know, if I really need the smite to go off, okay, I'll burn a command point and make it happen.
Yeah, or you need to convert a damage roll from 1 mortal wound to 3 mortal wounds.
Give me the shot.
Why not? Exactly. Do it, right. You're positioned very well to do so.
You mathematically go to a 75% chance of doing 2 or more mortal wounds with command points. So good luck.
And that's the Malefic Lord. So those are one of the things that you definitely will encounter on the tournaments that include Forge World. Now, Adepticon recently published their preview of what the team tournament will be. And I'm only mentioning that because Adepticon has always done this, especially for the team tournament. I don't know what their singles will be, but they have limited Forge World options to a one choice only. So one per unit. So you only have one of each choice from a Forge World unit in your army. That would be, I'm pulling things out of the air, one Lucius Pod, one Malefic Lord, one unit of Basilisk Carriages, one Spined Beast of Chaos kind of thing. You couldn't include multiples of those with a power level restriction of, I want to say 30 power level. So we may see things like that come about. The Malefic Lord, very powerful, something that people are going to include a lot. Be on the lookout for it.
Yep, gotta know what's coming.
And speaking of which, the giant Chaos Spawn. This, I'm not as sold on. I'm going to read the stats and you guys tell me what you guys think. This is out of the Index Forces of Chaos, page 55 from Forge World, the Imperial Armor Chaos. This is from the Chaos side of the thing. This is a different book altogether than the Malefic Lord. This is a Weapon Skill 4+, Toughness 5, Wounds 10. It has a melee weapon, the strength of the user, and you roll randomly for what its strength is based on its number of wounds. Whenever a roll is made to set one of the giant chaos spawn's multiple character or mutable characteristics, and a 1 or 6 is rolled on any d6 or d3, the giant chaos spawn gains d3 wounds. So, not terrible. This may be used to take it above its starting total of 10 wounds. If the giant chaos spawn ever reaches a total of 20 wounds or more, it gains the Titanic keyword until its wound total is reduced to 19 or less. So from 10 to 19 wounds, it has a movement of 6 plus d6, a strength of 6 plus d3, and attacks of 6 plus d3.
It seems good. I'm not sold on these things. And let me rephrase. They're really good options. I think they're really fun units to play if you're not trying to play the Apex power builds for Chaos. If you're not trying to do Smite Spam or Magnus and Demon Prince Assault Rush, cool. Go for these things.
It's 75 points, if that changes your opinion. It is not expensive.
Certainly not expensive, but at the same time, like, is this really going to supplant your...
It's a heavy support choice, so I'm only listing its full stats here or giving details just for the proper context. I am also not sold on these, although I see people including them. These may be people who roll a lot more sixes than I do, or threes in the case. Get those stats up.
What was it you said we were playing against Phil, the Glacial Geek, last night, and you were like, I forget what you did, what happened, but you rolled boxcars. I think it was on saves. You need sixes, and you rolled boxcars, and you were like, yeah, I'm really good at 40K. Right. you just roll sixes and win, man. That's the way to play.
Well, there was that one round where I think every charge was rolled 11 inches on both sides, on his side and our side. That was this is after the round where we spent 9 rolls and couldn't get an 8-inch charge.
We got a single we rolled 9 attempts and got a single 9+. Yeah.
But that's how streaky the game can be, whatever. But I think this thing is also going to be streaky. I mean, maybe I'm missing something, and believe me, people will tell us when they think we're wrong, and that's good. That's actually how we keep it coming. I mean, that's one of the ways we improve and see some gaps in our logic. But this thing being as cheap as it is a benefit. And the fact that it comes with 10 wounds with a 5+ invulnerable save is pretty good.
Yeah.
The model's cool, too. So we can't discount that.
But I just don't see it being like something you build around.
I think it's like, I have the model. I got some points here. Let's throw it in, and you're going to have fun with it.
It does have the demon rule, but it doesn't have a Heretic Astartes, and it just doesn't seem like it. Anyway, I don't want to downplay it because I'm sure that there's something that I'm missing because it has been successful for people. I'm just saying that if I were going to choose something out of this book, I'm not sure I would choose the giant chaos spawn as my go-to. But it is only 75 points.
I guess my response to it is like a lot of chaos players who I know and respect are kind of losing their minds about it and talking about how good they are. And so I'm like, there's got to be something here that I'm just missing. Or maybe more accurately, there's a space to fill in chaos lists that this model, these units are going to fill.
Well, it is a demon. It is a demon. So in chaos demons, there probably is some space. Whereas, you know, maybe I'm coming at it from the too much Heretic Astartes, the chaos space brain side, and I'm just not seeing it.
I don't know if there is space for it because all that space is filled with a billion burning horror
little brimstone
things. Yeah, there's just no room on the table.
That's a physics joke, people.
Gotta be something said for that, right?
But please, please let us know what your thoughts on that. There may have been some confusion on the last episode where we were talking about the Adeptus Mechanicus Forge Worlds. And I think that, if Andrew, that we actually got a lot of questions or some contention around your interpretation of what you were saying was a feel no pain save for the Forge World dogma to where you lose your last wound. And I wanted to clarify that just for folks that may be curious from the last episode. And what you were saying was, on that last wound or when you are removing a model, that dogma, it was similar to a feel no pain save.
Yeah, it reads like feel no pain.
For that last wound, not for every wound of say of a Castellan robot. It would just be for that last wound when you're about to remove the model. That's when you would get something like this.
Correct. I mean, if you read, there is no feel no pain anymore, right? That's the rub. There's no standardized like base universal rule to compare it to.
Just using common terms that people might be that some folks might be familiar with, but if you're coming into eighth, you don't even know. You have no idea what that means. So right. It's worth mentioning. But that is the Graia refusal to yield. Roll a d6 each time the model is slain or flees, and so that would be on the removal of the last wound where you get this roll into effect.
Yes. And I'm really confused as to what the confusion was. I understand that there were some people who were like, well, that's Whitaker was saying it wrong. That's not how it works.
I could have edited it wrong. Who knows? I'm not, yeah, exactly. I don't even look, I'm not putting any blame on anyone. I'm just simply clarifying what that is, but that's the kind of feedback we get that we appreciate, because it allows us to have, again, it's all about linking the logic together to play better. And that's part of what we want to do. And so keep that kind of feedback coming. And we appreciate the folks that did reach out to us about that.
Yeah, we always want to be as clear as we possibly can be, and if we're wrong, we're wrong, and we're happy to hear how wrong we are. As egotistical as we sound, as Chris Morgan sounds, we want to be clear and consistent and to be responsive.
I didn't even mention how you kept calling the Calidus a he instead of a she, despite the appearance of the model.
We're going to take a quick break and come back with the finishing move segment. This segment, I'm going to title it, soft title is Put Down the Nolan Oil. We'll be right back.
Oh, man.
Make sure to grab your tickets for the SoCal Open 2017, occurring in lovely Del Mar, California, October 21st and 22nd. This awesome event features Warhammer 40,000, Age of Sigmar, Infinity, War Machine and Hordes, Drop Fleet and Drop Zone Commander, and so much more.
Hey everybody, we are back. I hope you enjoyed that message from our sponsors. I told you the soft title of this segment is going to be Put Down the Nolan Oil, but the real core of finishing moves is breaking out of your comfort zone, and I want to talk a little bit about that today, because we have often touted, and this is not even like, this is not hyperbole, this is as true as it could possibly be, the Nolan Oil and the Agrax Earthshade is being quite literally liquid talent.
They get the job done.
Skill in a bottle.
I subscribe to that. I think that once you start getting into a rhythm of painting and you start understanding how those should be your go-to. The Nolan Oil and the Agrax Earthshade. I mean, heck, even look at Duncan's tutorials. And 80% of them are all about involve those washes in some way or another. They work. They do exactly what you expect them to do. They make your models look better. It is talent in a jar. But what if I told you don't have to use those to get similar or unique effects on your models? Even if you just kind of like half use them. Maybe you mix a little bit of the green shade in with the Agrax as you start to ease yourself out of your comfort zone. There are other washes out there to use.
Yeah, I find this the most true when working with flesh that isn't human flesh, like orc flesh, for example. My particular orc recipe, I use the Coelia or Coelia green shade on top of a brighter green to help the recesses darken up, which darken up always sounds weird, but really that's what you're doing. Because if you put Agrax or Nuln in there, I mean, the Nuln, yeah, the black is going to darken those recesses, but you're going to lose some of the green for having done that.
You could do green over gray, too, and you get a slightly bit of ethereal effect and still get that green inside. You have a deep green within the recesses without compromising the color. But this is what we're talking about. It's about using other washes to do the exact same thing that you may have skipped over on the shelf every time you go to the hobby store.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the biggest examples would be, you know, we've talked about flesh, and Agarax Earthshade is just, it's such a no-brainer for flesh. But you can also get away with using a purple wash or a blue wash on skin tones.
If you want it to look more sickly or, you know, alien, just there's so many options you can go with there instead of just going for that normal flesh tone with, you know, the Agarax or something like that. Well, throw some green in there or anything.
You want. You got to think of the tone that you want your figure to have. Like, for instance, you see a lot of tips where they use purple washes on marine faces because it gives them a little bit more of a human, more of a realistic maybe look to them, as opposed to just using the Reichlin flesh shade, which is almost a rosy color. It's a much more better brown. But this is the kind of stuff you need to think about when you are washing things. This is not a segment of washes are bad. Washes are amazing and will make your figures look even better than they did before if you're not already using them. But you know, when you're sitting there painting, you know what that model is going to look like when you put that Agarax or that Nuln oil on it. And there's peace there. There's comfortable. There's a certain like warmth and you know it's comfortable. You know exactly how it's going to look.
This is the fireplace, you know, the comfortable, cozy fireplace.
The Yule log of hobby. Well, yeah, and that's the thing. It's your comfort zone, you know. It's your snuggie of a hobby, right? So, but like sometimes you just gotta step out of that and try something new. Because I used the on my custodies, I almost went with it. I almost just threw some Nuln oil and some Agarax on there, and then I was like, well, what if we gave it a greenish tint to that gold? And so I put Baltan green.
Oh, that's some Excalibur stuff
on the gold. And it got this like real subtle gold tint to it, because I didn't want it to look like you know, corroded or anything, because these are the custodies. If anybody's going to take care of their armor, it's these guys. But I just wanted it to have that shade. And so that
they've got nothing else to do.
Exactly. I mean,
just hang out for 2,000 years, polished armor.
Yep. Talking to Dad, who ain't talking back.
There's plenty of Marine chapters that have done less.
Right. But it came out looking really cool and just really different than what I'm used to and different than what I'm used to seeing other people do. So it was just, it's fun to get some variety for yourself and, you know, at your local store to just kind of see something new.
Yeah. And kind of bringing up what Paul brought up earlier about mixing some of the washes together. I would just be very careful about doing that. If you're going to get creative, always test it out. I don't think we can say that enough. So before you just slather 20 models with a bunch of wash, unless you're doing Tyranids, because who cares if you're sloppy? You want to do a test. You want to make sure it works, to make sure it looks good. And you want to have at least a basic knowledge of how colors mix together. Because if you're putting like two complementary colors together that are washes, you're going to end up with a brown anyways. And just because it's brown and not Agarax Earthshade, that doesn't mean you're off the hook for the purposes of this conversation.
Agreed, man. I'm painting Mortarion, which is an amazing model. I'm in love with the character, number one. But it's one of the best models. It just goes together so well, and it's an intimidating model to look at. And you may think it's going to be like crazy hard to paint, but it isn't. But there are hoses and stuff on him. And by the way, I'm not good at painting those. Like, he has those Tyranid hoses on him in a couple spots where it's the hose, but the hose is torn away where you can see like the under, whatever the under thing is, like on a Tyranid, it's some kind of organic part, but this may be like a piece of cabling that's under some type of organic sleeve or whatever on his hoses. Do you guys know what I'm talking about?
Sort of.
In any event, I'm not good at painting those. Let me just say that. I'm just not good at that. So I hit up one of my buddies. I'm like, I don't know what to do here. But I found that Nurgling Green is a lighter shade than Death Guard Green. And I thought it would look good as a nice little accent point on the model. But I didn't know what to do with those, how to shade it in those hoses and that cabling or whatever the heck is on there or whatever. And I hit up a buddy. He's like, how about a green wash or a brown wash? And then the next text was like, how about both? I was like, you know what? I'm going to go with both. Mix a little of that Kolya Green Shade and a little bit of Agrax together, still within my comfort zone, but gave me a unique element on the model that stands out from the rest of the model, just like that this bit should have.
We're talking about painting, so this is not necessarily my time to shine, but I think that it's interesting with object source lighting. If you're talking about doing it, different colored shades really help bringing out source lighting, whether that's, you know, washing your plasma guns in green so that the recesses on the plasma ridges are that deep dark green or light green on the armor that you're trying to do OSL on.
Jump in, if you do the same thing to the nozzle of the weapon, it makes it ties the whole thing together and makes that stuff pop out. People will notice that more than they'll just notice one element or the other.
That's exactly right. So when as you're talking about Mortarion and stuff like that, especially with those big large characters, OSL is a fun thing to play with, and washes are a great way to kind of manipulate how those lights play off each other, how that paint scheme plays off each other, and a great way to enrich your model that's not super difficult to do, where you're just like, yeah, instead of using Agthrax or Nuln here, I went ahead and did a light green wash, and so then it looks more putrid or more plasma-y or...
It blends the model together. Some people I know use the wash as their last step. They'll get everything all painted up, and then they'll wash it, and that's the last, or dip or whatever. The premise is still the same, and that's the last thing they do to their model before they seal it, if they seal it. The wash doesn't have to be the last step. It could be part of the look of the model. You can paint over and around washes just like you see Duncan do, and you can achieve really cool effects when you're using different colors that you did not expect to use. And I'm not even just talking about Games Workshop washes. I'm talking about lots of different stuff out there. Find a color that you like that may look good on your model, and don't be afraid to use it, even though it's not your go-to, because you know exactly how that wash is going to look. And it's comfortable. I understand, especially if you're painting and your edges adding to an army. You know, I get it. You're not going to change up. You don't want to change that up, but you can add a little bit more spice to things by branching out your colors of wash.
And just to add on top of that, you know, do not forget that you can use a median to turn any color you paint with from any range into a wash that'll go on smooth. And just doing it with water isn't going to create the effect.
Something like the Lamia medium or a glaze medium, yeah, or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. There's a bunch of different products that you can use. I'm totally sold on Lamia median.
It's the best.
But I would just say don't feel too scared to branch out and try something with that median. If there's a color that you really want that it isn't in the pre-made bottles for wash, that is the best way to go about it.
Yeah, the glaze mediums and the Lamia, this is all stuff that helps. What it does is it changes the consistency of the wash or the paint without changing the properties, because you're adding things to it that are it's the base element of the paint or the wash or whatever. So that's, you're not changing the properties other than its ability to flow. And that's why it works so well. And some of this stuff can come to light. Like the Citadel paint app, if you haven't already gotten it, get it. I don't know if you'll hear about it by the time you download this show. They are running a contest this week to where they are giving away every paint in their line to people that have downloaded the app. So yeah, I'll try to get this up as soon as possible, so you may have a day or so before the contest expires. But if you haven't clicked through this app, they do a bunch of paint examples on a Space Marine backpack, because it has a bunch of ridges and edges and stuff. It's a good way to show the paint. But it has tons of recipes in there, and it's worth checking out.
Totally.
Talking about, you want to learn how to paint internal organs? You want to know which wash to put on internal organs? It's got you covered.
And you don't even need to go to medical school.
We've been hanging out too much, because I knew he was going to say it before he even said it. Like, I've hung out with Chris too much at this point, because I'm already getting his dad jokes now.
If you're curious about the internal organs, it's in the pink section when you're trying to choose the color. But it also gives you what it is. It gives you recipes based on some common things. Like, it doesn't, it may tell you how to paint Black Templar armor and gunmetal and ivory, but it's things that you can kind of commit to memory as, oh, I could put this here or there. And then it tells you kind of how to do it, you know, with their colors, but it tells you the steps and the order in which you do it. You can also categorize What I used this for recently, this is not even a plug. I used this recently because I am guilty 100% of going to the hobby store and not remembering the paints that I got there to buy. Is that just me?
No, that's everything. It's everyone, because I finally made a spreadsheet for my my Warlord that I started painting on finally, and because it's so big and there's so many different things on it, I was forgetting, you know, it, from day to day, like what color was what, and I was starting to like have these panic attacks that I was going to have this like hodgepodge looking model by the end of it. So yeah, that alone is the biggest issue for I think most painters out there who have projects that take longer than a month or two to get together.
You can plug in your inventory and your wish list into this thing, and so it's one of those ways to help keep track of stuff. So with that,
that's a pretty marvelous thing, right? Like you just pass along to your wife, give her the wish list.
Yeah. Which green did I need? Oh, it's that one. Which whatever did I need? Oh, it's that one. Like, I've even branched out. I bought Demonette Hide. Never knew what that paint was for.
Low key, I know we're, you know, it's still early in the fall or whatever, but it is actually really helpful to be like, I know that when my wife walked into a game store one time, I had requested a particular model and she was like, and some paint. And she was like, I have no idea what in the world you're talking about. If she had a little more direction, that would have been probably more helpful for her.
That's love, though, man.
Exactly.
Well, guys, we will go ahead and tie this up. I appreciate y'all hanging in with me, and I want to hear about y'all's hobby experiments that you have. Look forward to seeing some work in progress shots on Twitter. You guys, have a good rest of y'all's night. We'll talk next week.
Good night, guys.
Night. Cheers.
Thanks for listening.